Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome, UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Jamila Battle. Welcome, Jamila.
Welcome.
You know, we're going to have a great show today, in part because we're talking with Dr. Daniel Weinberger, Director and CEO of the Leiber Institute of Brain Development, and Professor John Hopkins University School of Medicine, about how childhood trauma can alter DNA. Any one of those three, four things would have been fascinating. You put them all together, that should be really interesting.
And it's a relevant topic as well.
Yeah, you know, we know that childhood trauma has such profound impacts, and perhaps the mechanisms we're probably just beginning to understand. I bet he understands it at levels that we can learn from.
We certainly can learn from this, and it's been studied starting with one of the first studies with the ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experience Study, and I think it's fascinating that we continue to have the conversation because it's important, it's relevant. I hope to learn very much today and add to the conversation.
In addition, we know that we have thousands of immigrant children who've been exposed to trauma that's all in the news recently. Deep breath. We'll be interested in his thoughts on those issues as well. But first, we have some really interesting research that matters on some really diverse topics. Let's dive right in. And the very first one is about legalized marijuana and rates of mental illness. This is an interesting, important topic done actually by our colleagues at Research Triangle Institute.
So it looks like they discovered a relationship between marijuana legislation, marijuana use, and mental health, and that the risk of certain mental health problems is higher if you use marijuana, particularly heavy marijuana use.
Yeah, and on the face of it, that shouldn't necessarily be too surprising because we know that heavy marijuana use can lead to psychosis and schizophrenia, but we also know that increasingly a lot of states have both legalized marijuana recreational use, but even more so have legalized medical marijuana. And they're starting to now look at how are those legalized marijuana, both recreational and medicinal, related to any changes in perhaps mental health. And this is some associations that they were looking at.
And they said that that relationship between marijuana use and mental illness is not really well understood. And maybe it could be that people with mental illness are self-medicating, or in some cases, marijuana exacerbating some latent condition.
And so, again, this is not cause and effect, and a lot of people didn't like this particular study. 29 states have legalized medical marijuana, and 8 states have legalized recreational marijuana. And the Research Triangle Institute, RTI study, only looked at the medical marijuana laws without regard to recreational use. So, to my way of looking at it, that would have been much smaller numbers would have been involved in using the medical marijuana. So I found it interesting that they found an association. It may be important. It may be real. If true, would be some serious cause for concern, if true.
I certainly think that there's some truth to this. As an addiction physician, there's no free ride in the brain. And certainly over time, particularly with heavy use, we develop tolerance. We have a down regulation of receptors. And particularly there is some dependence issues that occur, as well as a withdrawal phenomenon. So we may feel really great initially, but then there's that anti-reward withdrawal that can look like worsened anxiety, insomnia. So when we seek out the effect, it turns out we actually get the opposite of what we were looking for.
Yeah. So this will need a lot more research and following because, again, I think you've hit it that there is no free ride and there may be really positive aspects in some cases for people, but there may be some other negative aspects as well. And we should understand both fully as we're moving forward. our next Research That Matters, a really important topic, which is about ways of potentially lowering suicide risk in kids. And that would come from parents' spirituality or religion. Fascinating. Oh. How would that work?
Well, to me, when I first read this, it seemed kind of like, oh, okay, common sense. If there is an organizing principle around kind of who we are and how we live, that this would provide some kind of structure to give the family a sense of purpose.
Yeah, and this was actually a research article that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal Psychiatry, and it was a 30-year, three-generation family study done up at Columbia University, and it studied on the adult children and grandchildren, generations 2 and 3 of those who were initially in the study. And they were looking at kind of answers to questions across these generations about how important is religion or spirituality, how often do they attend church, synagogue, other religious or spiritual services, and what denomination are you? And they found that those of whom there was a higher importance of religion and spirituality in the parents had a 40% lower risk of suicidal thoughts among the boys and the girls in attempts, showing that there was a protective effect of spirituality, which I just thought was, it's important. Mm-hmm. Suicide of children and adolescents, really one of the most tragic things I can think of.
And I think it's important to note that it wasn't about how much time they spent at the church or what religion, but really about having the inner belief that gave them some kind of strength. And it was also independent of the children's opinion of the religion.
Yeah. The things that seem to be protective to some kids from committing suicide, things like not perceiving themselves as burdensome, having a sense of belonging, and not wanting to hurt themselves, things that are important to community, and perhaps that religious aspect is a sign of something in the community. So great, important research. Our last one quickly is about labor induction at 39 weeks. Can that decrease the need for a C-section? Major news study.
And this looks like what they found is that women who choose to induce at 39 weeks delivered nearly 1 week earlier than women who waited for spontaneous labor, and that the C-section delivery was significantly less likely after elective induction than after expected management. That was 18.6% versus 22.2%.
Right. So that meant for every 28 deliveries, they eliminated one C-section. Mm-hmm. You put that over the whole United States population, that's tens of thousands of C-sections that are going to be eliminated. This was in the New England Journal of Medicine. And they did find that there was no increased rates of adverse effects from that induction of labor. As a matter of fact, there was less likely to develop preeclampsia, a very severe condition that can really end up causing eclampsia, which can be very damaging to the mother and the child. So there could well be benefits. They're not saying all women should be induced at 39 weeks, but they're really saying there should be an informed discussion with women, and that should be offered. I think that seems reasonable.
That's very important.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Daniel Weinberger, director and CEO of the Leiber Institute of Brain Development, professor at Johns Hopkins University, about how childhood trauma can alter DNA. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's No. 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Today on Conversations, Jamila, we're talking with Dr. Daniel Weinberger, director and CEO of the Leiber Institute of Brain Development and professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, about how childhood trauma can alter DNA.
Welcome, Dr. Weinberger.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you on the show, and we're going to spend a fair amount of time really understanding your research and things that we're equally passionate about. But we're also really interested in, how did you get interested in this topic of childhood trauma?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question. So I pretty much stumbled onto this issue of childhood trauma. I've been working for a number of years now and understanding how genes in the environment affect the building of human brains. And that translates into how genes and the environment converge on developmental brain disorders. Developmental brain disorders are disorders like autism, intellectual disability, attention deficit hyperactivity or ADHD disorder, schizophrenia, many of these behavior disorders that have pieces of their origins in early development turn out to be the result of genetic programs that alter brain development and also environmental factors that modify these genetic programs. I was trained as a psychiatrist and a neurologist, and I'm board certified in both of these specialties, but have had a career as a researcher, first for almost 30 years at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, and now for the past 7 years at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. So the interest in childhood stress emerged from studies of how the environment influences the genes that lead to the function of all the cells in our body. And one of the great discoveries in medical research in the past 20 years was that environmental experience doesn't change the letters of your genetic code, but it changes how genes that are the result of your genetic code can be turned on or turned off. And the biology of every cell in your body is determined by which genes are turned on and turned off. So just to make that a little bit more obvious, every cell in your body, every organ in your body, comes from the very first fertilized egg. That builds every cell and every organ in your body. And that fertilized egg has one genome. It has one genetic sequence that it got from your two parents. But a liver cell knows that it's not a lung cell. And a lung cell knows it's not a brain cell. How does it know that? If they all have exactly the same letters in their genetic code, which they have to have because they came from the same cell to begin with, how do they know that they're supposed to be a lung cell and not a brain cell? They know that because of a modifying process that regulates how genes are turned on and genes are turned off. Scientists call this epigenetics. That's what it's called. And epigenetics is about how proteins that wrap the DNA molecule allow the DNA molecule to be opened so that genes can be turned on and turned off. And a lung cell has a unique set of proteins that make it a lung cell. A liver cell has a unique set of proteins that make it a liver cell. And the regulation of the DNA in each of those cells determines which of these genes and which proteins are there and which aren't. And that's how we differentiate the different organs and cells in our body. So this process that happens during development of changing the landscape in every cell of which genes are on and which are off can be influenced by what's happening in the environment.
So how does psychological stress or toxic stress or extreme stress from childhood trauma affect that DNA?
So there are many animals. We don't know this from human beings because it's very hard to do these experiments in human beings. We can't subject people voluntarily to experience extreme stress in childhood. Regrettably, there are many children in many parts of the world whose life is characterized by a series of extreme stresses. But we can't determine what their DNA, their epigenetic state might look like if they hadn't been exposed to it, which would be a biological experiment. We can do this in animals. And there have been many studies that have shown that extreme stress early in life in an animal causes lifelong changes in the epigenetic state of their cells. And it's believed that there have been a number of studies that have shown that early childhood toxic stress, which for children, you know, is usually neglect, abandonment, physical or psychological extreme stress, comparable kinds of stresses in animals change the epigenetic state of the genome in many cells in the body, and they cause the biology of those cells to be altered for a lifetime. And what scientific research has taught us is that these kinds of processes are not likely to be unique to experimental animals. They're likely to be features that characterize all of the animals on this planet to one degree or another, including human beings.
So do we differentiate between the psychological stress and what it does to expression of these proteins and the epigenetics versus things that might affect it environmentally but maybe aren't psychological stress? I'm thinking about lead exposure or exposure to secondhand smoke, which we know both of which severely influence childhood cognitive processes.
Right. So environment does not mean whether you're having a fight with somebody. It does not mean only psychological stress, although it certainly can mean psychological stress. But it also means what we might call molecular stress. Molecular stress could be toxins in the food, toxins in the water, drugs. So clearly molecular environmental stresses are part of what the environment represents. We had a study from the Lieber Institute for Brain Development here at Johns Hopkins that was published in a journal called Nature Medicine in May, which showed that complicated pregnancies, which we know have been risk factors for many developmental disorders, including autism, intellectual dysfunction, ADHD, schizophrenia, many of these conditions have been known for years to have an increased probability of occurring in people that have had complicated pregnancies. What we showed in this research in May was that the reason complicated pregnancies have an influence on these conditions is because they affect the health of the placenta. And they do this by changing the genes that are turned on and off in the placenta. And the placenta is a critical environment that the growing fetus lives with. The placenta is the critical organ that nurtures with all the nutrients of development the growing fetus. So this is a pure example of how environmental stress, in this case a complicated pregnancy, which can be high blood pressure, diabetes, nutritional problems, etc., create a biological stress to the placenta, which affects its biology and then indirectly affects the biology of the growing fetus and is likely to be a risk factor for these developmental behavior disorders because it slightly compromises the environment of a growing fetus.
So those are the purest or more physiological examples. But in a psychological example, I know even in my own case, I experienced toxic stress from childhood trauma and wrote about it. But there was an ACEs study that I discovered, and they did a prospective and retrospective trial where they compared health status to these ACE scores and found that a score of 4 or more, there was an increased risk for adverse health outcomes. And it wasn't because they were, for example, behaving negatively. It was because of the cortisol or HPA axis or these pro-inflammatory proteins that are turned on from the epigenetics that you're speaking of. Is this something that they found in the research that you've done?
So we haven't looked at that specifically, but I think you're right on here. This is an accurate reflection of the current thinking about how you change the epigenetic state, because these inflammatory proteins and cortisol, which are the stress-related molecules that are released in the blood, they get into what we call the nucleus of every cell, and they affect these proteins that wrap the DNA and that are what we call the epigenetic factors. And we think that the way toxic stress, which is not just psychological stress, it can be, but can also be molecular stress, the way that changes the epigenetic state of the genome, at least partially, is because it increases the release of these inflammatory proteins and cortisol and probably other stress-related molecules, which all are active biological factors for changing the epigenetic state of our genomes, which is also why when those studies have been done, they've shown that toxic stress not only increases risk for behavior problems, but also increases risk for diabetes, for pulmonary problems, for heart problems throughout life, because all the cells in your body are affected by this, and the integrity of many organs are affected. I think it's important for the listeners to appreciate that we're talking about factors that change how at risk you are. They aren't factors that guarantee anything. So it's a little bit like thinking about cholesterol. Cholesterol is a risk factor for heart disease. It's a risk factor for stroke. But it doesn't cause all by itself heart attack and stroke. These are not events that guarantee a particular outcome, but they do increase the probability of that outcome.
Right.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue to talk with Dr. Daniel Weinberger, Director and CEO of the Leiber Institute of Brain Development and Professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, about how trauma and environmental stresses can alter DNA. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Golson and Dr. Jamila Battle. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Daniel Weinberger, Director and CEO of the Leiber Institute of Brain Development and Professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, about how childhood trauma and other types of trauma can alter DNA. And right before the break, you were really explaining, I think, and I think really helping us all come to the place where we really understand how these factors interplay and really change the risk for expression of really diseases across the whole spectrum. And I wonder if we could maybe take an example from the past, what you learned from research on Romanian orphans. I think it's a sad but important lesson to understand.
Right. So I personally have done no research with the Romanian orphans, but it's a very famous set of studies that were done by a group of investigators in Maryland and elsewhere in the United States. There were several in Romania. There were a number of orphanages where children were raised in very extreme circumstances. And a group of psychologists from the United States studied these children. They were raised in very deprived circumstances. It was noteworthy that they had very little nurturing. They had very little cuddling as children. They were pretty much without significant adult caring. And they have been followed now for several decades, in fact. And the evidence is very clear that they have a disproportionate number of medical and psychological problems that are really quite profound. One of the more remarkable studies that were done with them was that they had magnetic resonance imaging scans done of their brains when they were in their teenage years, and their brains were slightly, but as scientists would say, significantly smaller than the average brain size of children without similar emotionally deprived backgrounds. And so this has been a landmark naturalistic experiment, if you will, to show that there are long-term implications for the development of the human brain. You know, human beings are very unique among all animals in that we have a very protracted period after we're born in which we're totally dependent on our environment to provide us with the care and nurturing that we need to become independent, functioning adults. Most other animals, within a year or two, at most among other primates, can live independently. Human beings cannot live independently for many years after birth. And part of what happens during that period of time is that your brain is developing. And it's developing based on experience, learning, and also these genetic programs that are meant to grow a brain for a number of years after birth. And what the Romanian orphanage has shown is that severe environmental deprivation during the first few years of life, and this was really severe deprivation of these children. They were fed, they were barely clothed, but they were certainly not given any emotional nurturing. Led to very profound results in terms of brain development.
And what about an example of a current situation, such as the separation of the immigrant children from their parents?
Well, I think we operate under the assumption that the first few years of life, it's critical that children have as limited a stressful experience as is possible. And from my view, and I don't think I'm unique in having this view, separating infants from their parents, particularly in an environment that is completely foreign to them, among complete strangers. It's not like having to go away for work and you're left with your grandparents, or you're left with your aunt and uncle, or you're left with your siblings. This is being left with complete strangers in a strange land where people don't even speak the language that you've ever heard before. I mean, this is an extreme stress for children. There's no question about that. There have been many studies that have been done in non-human primates, monkeys, of early childhood separation from their parents. They produce profoundly abnormal outcomes during childhood and later in life. This is an extreme childhood stress. There's no way to minimize the magnitude of that kind of stress. That's probably as an extreme stress as a one-year-old, two-year-old can have. I mean, I think that will clearly have epigenetic, as we call it, ramifications.
So we know that the exigency, the need, the necessary, the moral right to reunite these parents with their children, you know, that seems to be really the only way. In terms of many stresses, though, it seems like you've had a stress, and Jamila, I'm sure you can speak to stresses. What do we know about the research that tells us where to go with this, how we begin to repair and maybe ensure that those epigenetics don't turn on?
Such a great question, and that's a concept of resilience, and part of that, leveraging resilience and reversing some toxic stress from my childhood. I wrote a book about it, but there's also diet and exercise and therapy and storytelling and, you know, all sorts of data that speak to reversing this. What have you found?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Jamila, you say that. I have to say, one of the, we have a council of champions associated with the Lieber Institute for Brain Development. One of our council's members, which I'm sure many of your listeners know very well, is Naomi Judd. And Naomi Judd has also written about toxic stresses in her life. She wrote a beautiful book about this about a year and a half ago that was published, and about her really 20-year struggle with depression that was directly related to many of her early life experiences. This is not that unusual, regrettably. So I think, as you've said, there are two things we have to focus on. One is we have to recognize how critical these first few years of life are for providing a child with a secure environment, with as stress-free an environment as possible, because it's a period of time where the epigenetic state of the genomes in our cells is uniquely sensitive to what's happening in the environment. One of the groups of researchers here at the Lieber Institute for Brain Development has demonstrated, by looking at how the epigenetic state of the normal human brain changes from being born to being age 20. And what they've shown is the rate of change of the epigenetic state, which is related to how sensitive your genome is to what's happening in your environment, the rate of change between the first 5 years of life is greater than all of the rest of life put together. This is the time of life where we, as human beings, are most sensitive, the cells in our body are most sensitive to these factors that change its epigenetic state. And those factors are these inflammatory proteins, lead in the water, severe psychological stress. Our genomes and the cells in our body are sitting there uniquely sensitive to environmental experience during that time of life. So we have to be aware of this. We have to realize that this is not just, we're sorry this happened to you. This is something with potential lifelong implications. Now, you mentioned, Jamil, this issue of resilience. Obviously, people are different. People have different genomes. People have different environmental resources. So people vary in their resilience. Some people are very resilient to these factors, and they can manage to find ways to put them behind them. Other people, because of their genes or their environmental resources, are less resilient. This is just the different flavors that human beings come in. Nobody's at fault because of this. This is just, we're all different, and we're different in many different ways, and among those differences are resilience to these kinds of factors. We also know that we can help people build resilience factors once they've been through these things by counseling, by providing environmental support structures, by giving people the opportunity to form trusting relationships that will help them endure these periods. This is part of human life, and we can do better probably than we currently do in providing the resources for people to be able to get beyond these experiences.
Thank you, Dr. Weinberger, for kind of sharing this broader perspective. It's really something to sit with. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We're going to need to take a break, but then stay with us as we'll be talking on House Calls about questions about your health. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about listener health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I have diabetes, and I've heard about a new glucose scanner that you don't have to prick your fingers to use. Is this something I could switch to?
You know, I think it's great that we're seeing innovation across all of medicine. We take it for granted that you have to prick your finger to get your blood sugar, you know, and so anything that could be done new and different would really be helpful.
For me, I know if I had to prick my finger, I think that would hurt, and I certainly would like to try that. Is it very expensive, though?
So these are relatively new, and so we're all, as providers, getting more used to them. And there are this glucose scanner that's out and available, and it's probably reliable. And increasingly, insurance companies will probably start to pay for it, whether they pay for it now or it's preferred because it may be more expensive. I wouldn't be surprised if it is a little more expensive. I think that the cost of the meter is around $30. That could, in theory, be one time. And a sensor is about $10, and you change that maybe once a week. So it could be, you know, $40 a month or something for ongoing maintenance costs. That's not terribly awful compared to what maybe is currently done with the strips and other things. And certainly if it prevented, you know, sticks, maybe a good thing.
I think it's worth it.
I would just, again, want to make sure that they really are getting reads. So, maybe for the first week or two, do both of them and see if they get the same answer.
I think that's fair.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So, good enough. What's our very next house call?
I'm 62 years old and healthy, though I did used to smoke, but I quit 5 years ago. I've been having back pain, and I went to see my doctor. They did an x-ray and said I had a compression fracture in my back that looked to be old. The doctor said I should definitely have a bone density scan to make sure I don't have osteoporosis. No one in my family has ever had osteoporosis. Do I really need to do this?
That certainly is an indication for a DEXA scan.
Yeah, bone density testing. You know, we think about it more often in women than men, and we say that most women should really have this when they get to be 65 if they haven't had it beforehand, and then if there are certain risk factors getting it beforehand. Mm-hmm. An unexplained fracture, you know, or a fracture with kind of minimal trauma, mm-hmm. you know, where most people might maybe turned their ankle and you broke your ankle, that might be a reason to do it. And then certainly if you're smoking as well, because that lowers the bone density and makes you more likely to do it. So I think in this case you have a compression fracture of the back. That's not usually something we see in people that often who really don't have something like osteoporosis unless they have cancer, which is really unusual. So I would think so.
And that's an indication. So definitely get that DEXA scan.
You know, I mean, there are other things that maybe there. Certainly if you had a family history of this, if you're on certain medicines that could lower the bone density, if you're on chronic steroids, you have rheumatoid arthritis, other things that put you on chronic steroids, that lowers your bone density. Kind of a host of other factors that could put you in there. So certainly talk with your primary care physician. Ask them, should I get a bone density scan? Seems like a reasonable question. Mm-hmm. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I'm about to move to a new state, and I've been getting my care with the same doctor for 20 years. What sort of things should I do to ensure that the new doctor I see in my new state knows about all my medical problems, including my history of cancer?
Ooh, history of cancer. That means that there's some real important to get that knowledge base transferred. Luckily, with our electronic medical records, that becomes easier, particularly if they share the same electronic record. Like we use this vendor called Epic, which many hospitals around the country use. And if you do, you can get easy permission so that I can see your medical records in any hospital you've been to, and you can see my medical records if you've been in my hospital, and your doctors can see them too. So that makes it really easy if you share that same electronic medical record.
And that's right. That's very informed, that question to even ask, because oftentimes, you know, you don't want to have gaps in care, and so you want the information for the transferring doctor available.
You know, one of the things I would also say is ask your doctor, would they be willing to talk with a new doctor? A lot of times you get asked, I get asked, well, do I know a new doctor in a different, you know, state? And a lot of times if I don't, I may ask my colleagues, do you happen to know? I had someone recently who was moving to St. Louis. They want to know a doctor in St. Louis. And it turned out we had a graduate of our program from 10 years ago that was practicing in St. Louis. And that was always great to be able to refer to a colleague who you've trusted. And, you know, and then it's easy enough for me to reach out and say, you know, a patient of mine's moving up there. Would you be willing to take over their care? Because that's another thing, finding a doctor who's willing to take over your care and is willing to invest the time. And then you can say, I'd be happy to talk with you about them. They're a lovely person. You'll really, you know, enjoy meeting them. And then they will want to. And, you know, a lot of different things the doctor can do to help the patient.
That's right. And ask the doctor, because I think sometimes, you know, we in our training learn about care coordination. And in our busy days, sometimes I think we might find it hard to find the time. And so certainly advocate for yourself and ask.
Yeah. No, I think these are all good suggestions. Certainly with a cancer diagnosis, you may also want to make sure that the oncologist and the information from that oncologist is really there, particularly if you're on an experimental trial or really understanding exactly what was done, which treatments you had, which medications you had, so, and maybe what things you're allergic to. So thanks so much for that question, and thank you to all of our listeners today for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can send us any questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also follow us online at yourhealthradio.org or Twitter or Facebook or iTunes. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my guest co-host, Dr. Jamil Battle, and our guest today, Dr. Daniel Weinberger. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jamila Battle.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.